Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Anorexia is not a modern disease. The first medical report of the illness in 1689 was written by a London physician who described it as a condition caused by sadness and anxious cares. Even by the 1970s, though, our understanding was limited. In recent years, there's been something of an explosion of knowledge by way of scans that show how eating disorders affect the brain. But most treatments so far have fallen short when it comes to older brains. In other words, the longer you have anorexia, it appears, the harder it is to treat. The New York Times recently profiled a Central Ohio program that's taking a new approach and successful approach to the older patient. Joining us now is Dr. Laura Hill. She's CEO of the Center for Balanced Living. Welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Ann.
Nice coverage in the New York Times.
It was lovely coverage. It was very good.
Before we talk about your program specifically, let's talk again about the neurobiology of anorexia and what we've learned in recent years, because I think the last time you were on, it sort of popped up kind of at the end of the conversation, and it was really a new door opening.
It is. In fact, we have always looked at eating disorders from the outside in ever since they first became a diagnosis in 1980. And not until about 2005, when the MRIs became better and more detailed, and then we started looking at the fMRI, the functional magnetic resonance imagery, where a person could do a task, and then looking at the task while you're watching the brain, you can see how the brain is firing and compare that with different groups. Walter Kay from the University of California, San Diego, and you also had Christina Waringa, Dr. Waringa, both neuroscientists, and our center partners with UC San Diego on the brain research. And they have been looking at how the brain responds with anorexia for those when they're eating compared to those who don't have an eating disorder or those who have different eating disorders. And there are distinct areas of the brain that are firing, we could say malfiring or misfiring. And the result is that persons with anorexia have very little signals coming in to indicate hunger or fullness. So when you can say, I'm hungry, let's go get something, a person with anorexia have no idea if they're hungry. And when they're eating, they're getting no signals through the insula in the middle of the brain that is telling them when they're full. So we
or signals of pleasure or anything.
You got signals of pleasure they're not getting. So it's neither. And then in addition, when they start to eat, they begin to experience a response in the frontal cortex that is creating such noise and disturbance that the result is it's like eating poison ivy. It's like that. What, there's no pleasure in it. I'm getting an irritation from it, a mental irritation, and I'm certainly not hungry. Why even eat? And what we have found is to not eat is the only thing that quiets the brain. And so we interpreted that for years of you're just trying not to eat. You're just dealing with these diets. You're trying to be more competitive. We had all these outside-in theories.
You like being hungry.
You like, and so, or just eat this. You're just trying to avoid this. This is, we even had theories of fear of maturity, and it's all the family's fault, which at some point every diagnosis has had, it's all the family's fault.
Or the mother in particular.
Exactly, and the mother who is the wicked witch as well as the fairy godmother at times in life. And so the reality is the person with anorexia literally is eating blind and therefore is trying to maneuver around food, has a reaction to the food, and therefore, if you want me to work and function, I'd rather not eat until I get home, and then I'd rather not eat at all. And we now know that's true. The clients have been trying to tell us this for years, but we didn't understand it. We now know it's true, and because we have seen these truths in action in the brains of patient after patient, it's not just an anecdotal case. We now know it's a fact. And therefore, what we've been doing at the Center for Balanced Living here in Columbus has been taking that information and creating a treatment to respond to that with the help of the patients and their families so that we are responding in a way that's most effective and helpful. We've been developing this treatment for about 5 years with their feedback.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Laura Hill, CEO of the Center for Balanced Living. It was profiled, this new program that Dr. Hill just referred to was profiled in an article in the New York Times recently. We'll have a link to that article if you want to check it out at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Now, the issue of anorexia and why it's harder to treat in older people. First of all, what do we mean by older? How old can you get and have anorexia?
We have treated people up to age 84. And so as long as you're alive, the issue is a person may have that illness. It was once thought that it was an adolescent campaign for control when we looked at it in the 80s and early 90s. And the fact is, while the onset typically is after puberty, the fact is, at any point in time, a person who has traits that make them vulnerable, genetic inherited traits that set them up and make them vulnerable, may go through a major time such as pregnancy or menopause or a divorce. But the fact is, major transitions may set up the vulnerability. And once the genes literally turn on that are vulnerable in this to a whole new gear. And when that happens, literally the neurochemicals start flowing differently. The brain starts responding differently, and it's very hard to turn that off. We know a person's brain continues to grow up through age 25, and then, Ann, it's all downhill after that. And the fact is that while we continue, and the brain will always change, it's very plastic and continue to rewire itself. It's not growing the new wires the same. It can just rewire. And so the fact is, somebody who has maybe had the illness since their teens and are now 35, they're pretty well wired to sustain this illness and to be able to turn it around within 6 months to even a year or so is very difficult.
And to do so, or try to do so, with the standard treatment regimens is...
What often happens is people may go into a residential or inpatient care because they need to. They're medically unstable, and that's the best thing that could happen. When they come out of that, however, they will often then come back home, and that's when they're integrating back into work, because most people with anorexia are very intelligent and highly functioning if it wasn't for this illness. And so they want to go back to work, take on their law job, their executive job, their everyday job, and to be able to eat and to work becomes extremely difficult. And learning how to do that, make that work around the issues, is a very complex procedure.
So tell us about this program. You require that participants bring close people close to them, up to five.
Yes.
For this whole thing, and it lasts about...
1 week.
1 week.
So it's, in all my years, over 40 years in the field, this is the most intensive treatment I've ever seen, let alone helped create. And what the person does, we only take up to six clients. So it is a very small group in treatment.
And At a time.
Mm-hmm. For this 1 week, and they are in treatment with their support persons for 40 hours that week. And we approach it from the research that as they're making their own meals, so that they're learning what meals and what macronutrients need to go into their meal plan to sustain. We look at food as your fundamental, literally your first level of medicine. And we dose the medicine just like you would dose insulin for diabetes. And so we dose the macronutrients. You may need four carbs carbs, three proteins, and two endurance fuels, which we refer to as fats, but endurance fuels for your lunch. And so how to dose that, how to make that happen. Because if I can't tell if I'm hungry and I get no pleasure from it, then I don't want to overeat, undereat. And the fear that one's going to overeat is very high. And the disturbance when they do eat is very disturbed.
Well, let's talk about the fear of overeating. Is it the fear of getting fat?
Well, yes, on one level, thinking about it from the outside. But now let's look at it from the inside. Yeah. What we know in the parietal, which is like in the crown of your head, up at the top and starting towards the back, the parietal area is how you see your body within the space around you. And what we know with anorexia is, as the illness develops, the parietal is so disturbed that it's more disturbed in how you experience your body shape than the disturbance of schizophrenia. And so
that's the voices in the head kind of a thing.
The voices are near the front, the disturbances of how I perceive and experience my body. So literally when the person starts eating, they're seeing their body potentially drip fat, or it's a delusional, but it's not the same as schizophrenia.
Uh-huh.
But it is a disturbance that is very real. We used to say from the outside in, you're just making this up to convince yourself not to eat. We now know it's absolutely real. The disturbance is overwhelming. So therefore, to eat only provokes the monster, so to speak, and the disturbance is only going to get worse. But if you're dosing the food and you know you're dosing the right amounts, you can bring the food down to try to circumvent the disturbance. And therefore, many clients may start eating similar meals because then if I know how I feel about this, but any new foods can provoke a whole new disturbance.
Why bring family or close people with you?
Because the family is, in reality, the first line of treatment. They are the person, the husband is the one who lives with his wife every day. The adult child, the aunt, the mother, the father, these persons are central to one's life. They're the ones that want the person to get over this illness so they can start eating like everyone else. And the reality is, they may need to learn about the illness just like a family needs to learn about diabetes.
Is it realistic with someone who's been living with this, do you call it a disease?
Yes.
For so long, that they're ever going to just eat like everybody else?
There is a small percentage that they could. But the reality is there will probably always be, just like a person with type 1 diabetes, you never leave home without your insulin. You never leave without knowing how to match the food that you're eating with the insulin you take. The same kind of planning, preparation needs to be happening for a person with anorexia who is an adult and will probably need to do that forever. Spontaneity is out and planning is in. And the more they plan, whether they're going to a restaurant, how those macronutrients work, then they can learn to fit in, start integrating, and start practicing being able to eat and tolerate the side effects of that
food. So we're just about out of time, but give us some stories about people who have gone through this program now and what they're telling you.
Anne has been the life of the program. The patients are constantly the people who teach me. And to have people come in, a young patient in her mid-30s came in, and for her to be able to come in and say, I have never in my life had a life, and now I not only can eat and fix my own food, but my husband understands me for the first time, and he's at my side. We had another couple come in, and the wife said, I came to help my husband understand the illness, but I assumed I would never get over this. And she said, I've now learned, and she has conquered it. She said, I can eat with my children for the first time in their lives. And her husband said, we just now know what to do and to counter any of the symptoms, and we're on it, and we're living a full life forward.
You can only do six people at a time. There are millions. struggling with this.
Yes.
What kind of response have you gotten since the New York Times article came out?
We are getting response from all over the world, actually. We've had we've actually had patients from Guatemala, New Zealand, Europe, all of the states, Alaska, Texas, New York. They've all been coming in. We offer the program one week out of every month. And as we are continuing to collect our data to validate and refine it, we will then probably seek to try to, we're going to create a manual so others can be able to utilize this.
Is this something by any chance that insurance might cover?
Insurances are covering it. They are stepping up and they are covering it. And it's been quite excited. The Ohio State University's Managed Care, as well as Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, they are all saying this is making the difference, because when the patient goes home, the family is clearly the treatment person at their side.
Laura Hill, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a delight to talk to you. It's great to hear the good news about the Center for Balanced Living.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Anne.
It's Dr. Laura Hill. She's CEO of the Center for Balanced Living. Again, we'll put a link to that New York Times article about the center and its program to treat anorexia on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An estimated 5.4 million Americans, including 30,000 Central Ohioans, have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And the burden of caring for someone with dementia like that can be mentally, physically, and financially draining. Joining us now in the studio is case manager of caregiver support for the Alzheimer's Association Central Ohio chapter, Meredith Finley. Welcome to the show, Meredith.
Thank you so much.
And joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association Central Ohio chapter, Vince McGrail. Welcome to the show, Vince.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
The Alzheimer's Association's 2016 Facts and Figures Report was published last week. For families and friends caring for those with Alzheimer's, nearly half cut back on basic necessities such as food, transportation, and medical care for themselves to pay for dementia-related care. Vince McGrail, how much does this care cost?
Well, we've known for some time the physical and emotional toll on families, but this is the first time we've taken a real close look at the financial impact. And on an average for care contributors within families, what we find, first of all, many people need to cut back on their work. So on average, about $15,000 a year in lost wages because someone has to be there to provide the care. And then also, in addition, extra cost, maybe up to an average of $5,000 per person who provides some level of care for someone with Alzheimer's or dementia on top of that each year. So it's taking a tremendous economic toll on families as well.
What about Alzheimer's care programs?
Well, what we provide with our association, and Meredith can speak more about this with particular families, but First of all, early diagnosis is key. Finding out that someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and then coming to the association and sitting down with one of our care consultants to map out a plan so that you know what to expect. And as you plan for your finances, plan for retirement, to look at long-term health care. One of the unfortunate things we found in this report is that 2 out of 3 people that we surveyed thought that Medicare would cover long-term care support at nursing facilities, and that's not the case. So we need to really work hard to educate people about that financial planning.
What about, Meredith Finley, the physical and mental health effects for the caregiver beyond the sacrifice, the financial sacrifice and the time sacrifice? They often don't fare very well.
It's true. The caregivers, unfortunately, take the brunt of the responsibilities, and they are oftentimes neglecting their own medical needs, their own mental health needs. We see burnout rates, very, very common with these folks. It's a toll that also spreads to other family members, too. I mean, obviously, the primary caregiver is taking on a lot of the responsibility, but it really is a family responsibility, and it's very, very hard to manage your own needs when you're giving so much to the person who has this disease. And so, again, we're seeing folks neglect themselves, that their own medical needs aren't being addressed. So the physical toll is quite overwhelming.
Vince McGreal, you talked about the importance of, if you can, finding out, the earlier you find out about it, the better. How good are we getting at diagnosing Alzheimer's now at this stage? Where are we with that?
Well, we have a lot of work in front of us. We're working very hard at the association to educate primary caregivers, primary care physicians. And I'm here in D.C., and one of the things that we're pushing on is what's called the HOPE Act today, with 1,200 of our advocates from across the country. And the HOPE Act would push so that Medicare covers a care plan, so that instead of families, they get a physician who tells them that it's dementia and then might prescribe Aricept, a medication, and then say, come back and see me in 6 months. That would really help provide the coverage for sitting down with the family and mapping out a plan. And another thing that we do is push for those physicians to refer those people to our association so that we can help them. We've got a long way to go. But the great thing is that people are talking about it. I mean, we're here in D.C. It's tremendous to see. We've got 1,200 people here from across the country who have one voice talking about, we've got to continue this conversation. Families that we see every day in our office need to know where to turn when a diagnosis is there, and need to also understand what to look for so that they can understand the signs, so they can get their loved one to a neurologist and have a diagnosis.
Is the incidence of Alzheimer's increasing? Is it steady? Are we just getting better at diagnosing it, Vince McGreal?
I think we're getting better. We're getting better at diagnosing it, mm-hmm. and trying to get people to understand that it's not just a disease for those over the age of 65. It is also, we see many families with early onset, so families in their 40s or 50s with the diagnosis. And just, that's a part of the awareness that we're pushing on, is just families understanding what to look for.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the issue of Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Association's 2016 Facts and Figures Report was published last week. We'll give you a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. And Carol and Mansfield, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Ann. My husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's this past June, but it took 3 years to get that diagnosis. We finally had the spinal tap that was sent to, I believe it was Pittsburgh or Philadelphia, I can't remember, and they culture it for about 30 days. Not many people know about that. I'd like for your guests to speak to that. Additionally, I encourage anyone who is affiliated with Alzheimer's or has someone in their home to come forward. We've been very open about what's going on, and people have really stepped up to the plate to encourage us. Thanks for this program, Ann.
Yeah, thank you, Carol, for calling in. What about that, Vince McGreal? Can you talk about that test and how to diagnose it?
Well, thank you so much, Carol, for calling in. I was just in a meeting with Representative Stivers' office and was talking with another advocate here with the same situation, that it took 2 years for a diagnosis after a spinal tap, got the confirmed diagnosis. And we're going to talk the same thing with Representative T-Berry here in the afternoon with his office about the same thing, that we've got to push for more research and diagnosis. That leads us to better ways of getting quicker diagnosis for families.
Because if it helps to get a quicker diagnosis, then you got to get a quicker diagnosis.
Quicker diagnosis leads to a quicker plan, mm-hmm. so that you can plan forward instead of spending 3 years, as Carol did, waiting for that confirmed diagnosis, is to be able to understand what's going on, and you can map out a plan and have better education for yourselves to understand what the caregiving aspect is going to be.
Meredith Finley, if people suspect Alzheimer's but aren't sure about it, can they come to you anyway?
Yes, we would love for folks that have concerns or suspicions about any changes in cognition or any general questions about the disease to call us at our 1-800 number, our 24-hour helpline. We want folks to come forward, and that helps create more awareness, not only just for the family but for the community. Certainly, it is a big problem that we see a lot where families are overwhelmed and they're scared. And the stigma associated with this disease causes people to retreat. We want people to know that we're here as a source of guidance and support and information, and that we're here to hopefully be instrumental in getting a secure diagnosis and informing them about the options available to them.
So all things being equal, Carol sounded pretty good, like they're living it out loud.
I was so happy to hear that. That's what we love. And we encourage folks to share that information with their family members again, because it does take a family to help a loved one with this disease to care for their needs. And the more support can come forward, the better for everybody involved.
Are most people who have Alzheimer's being cared for by family?
Yes. We are seeing more folks stay within the home, utilizing the support services that they have through church, through other community sources. And certainly family members are the number one source of primary care support that we're seeing.
How big of a deal is respite in all of this and making sure you take the time to take care of yourself when you're a caregiver?
That is a big part of this, and we really encourage families to plan for respite. A lot of folks don't feel like they need it, but we're here to look for those red flags and encourage families to take that time off, helping you find somebody that you can trust, walking you through what that process is going to feel like. It's very easy to just say hand over the reins to somebody else, but it takes a lot of trust to develop in order for somebody to kind of let that piece go, even if it's for a night, for a week. We want to plan for respite because that leads to burnout.
Well, all it takes is one bad viral video out there of somebody mistreating somebody with some form of dementia to just do a lot of damage. I'm sure you've seen them, Meredith.
I have, yes. They're very, very sad, unfortunate, and we want to, again, try and be a part of the treatment plan to avoid having to go to long-term care. The goal of our program is to keep families informed and have their loved ones stay at home. Our goal is to not have to move loved ones out into the facilities. But when you do, we're here to talk about that process and what that means emotionally, mm-hmm. Financially. For the family involved.
Vince McGreal, what's the reaction been in Washington as you work on getting this funding?
Well, we're pushing hard to. The amazing thing was that our the research for Alzheimer's received a major increase from the federal funding last year that increased it by $350 million. But that only puts us just under half of what scientists say we need. Scientists say that we need $2 billion. To do the type of research we need to get a breakthrough, because what's going to happen is the incidence of Alzheimer's is going to triple.
Because people are getting older.
Because our population is growing older. Mm-hmm. And the cost is going to quadruple. So by this year, we're going to spend $236 billion as a nation on this disease. It's the most expensive disease we have. And by 2050, it's going to be over $1 trillion. That's double what our defense spending is this year. The reaction here so far, I've been in a couple meetings with our two state senators mm-hmm. this morning and our representatives this afternoon, and they're very supportive. They understand what's coming. And what's great is we've got all of these advocates. We've got 12 of our young professionals coming with us from Central Ohio talking about their family experience, talking about what they've seen in their parents when they were diagnosed. Giving that personal story to the representatives is just so powerful.
Pat in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Just a question. I'm in a caregiving situation with my husband with what we understand is the diagnosis with a kind of dementia. One of the things we discovered was, well, two things I'm going to say. The Central Ohio Alzheimer's Association has been a wonderful resource, and I just really encourage people to get in touch with them as far as classes and experiences we've had. The other question was, we found it's very difficult to find a cognitive neurologist in this area. And I realize insurance can affect that too, but we waited 3 months to see someone, and I think that's pretty common. I just wondered if there were any other suggestions for finding neurologists or that deal specifically with the cognitive areas we're talking about.
Okay. Pat, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Take care.
Thank
Meredith
you.
Finley, is there a shortage?
There is. We're hearing a lot of folks having a challenge in finding the appropriate physician to diagnose this type of disease. We encourage families, again, to call our 1-800 number as we have resources to help those folks that are in need.
Does the three-month wait sound typical?
It is, and sometimes it's much longer than that. Sometimes families are waiting up to a year, 2 years in some cases. Again, if you suspect that this is a change in your loved one that is not a normal part of aging, we want to connect you with that service as soon as possible so that you're not having to wait so long.
This is going to be a growing problem, Vince McGrail, as you said. Is there efforts to change, you know, or to encourage more physicians to go into this area?
Well, yes. One of the things that we're working on here, as I mentioned, some of the spending for Medicare coverage,
yeah,
and hoping that so one of the things we're looking at here from an association is called the PCHETA Act, which is a palliative and hospice care. So on that front, on the care front too, is some encouragement for the medical field to put more effort into certain areas so that we can recruit better people into those palliative care as well. But we definitely need to do something about the ability for people to see a specialist to get that diagnosis.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. I appreciate it. Once again, the Alzheimer's Association's 2016 Facts and Figures Report was published last week. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Meredith Finley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Meredith Finley, she's a case manager of the caregiver support team for the Alzheimer's Association Central Ohio chapter. And also Vince McGrail, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for speaking with us.
Vince McGrail, he's the executive director and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association Central Ohio chapter. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Kids soccer kicks off this weekend in most communities. That means it's time for the parents to divvy up the after-game snack schedule. Prepackaged snacks are easy, but they usually aren't the healthiest option. Registered dietitian Sally Kazemchak writes about this in her blog on realmomnutrition.com. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So when it comes to snacks for kids' sports, what are we shooting for anyways?
Well, ideally, I mean, Anne, I don't know if you played sports when you were a child, but when
No.
I was a young soccer player, we had orange slices on the sidelines.
Right. That was typical.
Yes. And those are kind of gone. And unfortunately, they've been replaced with all of this packaged cookies, cupcakes, donuts, bags of candy.
Everyone's trying to be the most popular parent.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And sports drinks, too. So bottles of Gatorade. And so what I am advocating for is sort of return to basics, back to basics, back to the fruit and water. Kids, and when we're talking about children who are playing recreation sports, you know, these are peewee soccer players who are sort of trotting around the field, breaking out to a run every now and then, maybe for 45 minutes or so. So these are not hardcore endurance athletes. So they don't need Gatorade. They need water and maybe some fresh fruit at the end is sort of a nice way to end things. And then they can go home and have a healthy lunch or a healthy dinner.
It's been hard, or how do you convince parents that it's just as easy to do it that way?
Right. Well, that is a big part of what I do on my blog. And what I want to show people is how easy it is to seriously just go to Kroger, buy some bananas, bring them to the field. What could be easier than that? Cut up some oranges, rinse off some apples. Some parents get really creative and do like fruit kebabs or cut up watermelon. I mean, we're starting to enter this great season of all this fresh mm-hmm. fruit, and so it's super easy to bring that to the field. Another option is just to eliminate the team snack entirely. So that sometimes works when parents can't seem to see eye to eye on what the appropriate snack for after these sports is. And if the coach doesn't even want to deal with it, I mean, these coaches are volunteers. They're taking so much of their time already. A lot of them don't really want the hassle of organizing the snack schedule or even dealing with it. So why not just have everybody bring whatever they want to the field or go home and have their own snack and just sort of eliminate that entirely?
Mm-hmm. Why do you recommend fruit as the best after sports snack?
Well, fruit is nice because it's hydrating. It has a lot of fluid in it. And after sports, you do need to rehydrate. And it has a little bit of carbohydrate to, you know, replace your energy. And it's easy. And most children do not get enough fruit every day. And the statistics are really grim mm-hmm. on the amount of fruit that kids are eating. So why not give another opportunity to get some fruit into kids and get them exposed to it. And what's really nice is that I've even seen on the teams where my children have been on where I bring fruit to the field, and maybe some kids are always really excited about it and some kids are reluctant, but when they see their teammates eating it, it's sort of like a positive peer pressure. And I've had parents come up to me and say, I didn't even know my child liked strawberries, or my child's never had a pear or whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're a picky eater. They see their teammates eating it. It's just sort of a nice way to end the game sort of, you know, around as a team having that snack. But at least it's healthy and it's nutritious and it's in line with what we're trying to teach them with sports, which is to be good to your bodies.
Do you think parents on your kids' teams feel extra pressure having Sally Kuzemchak as a fellow parent?
I do have a bit of a reputation in my community, for better or for worse, and I know that not everybody agrees with me. But I think at the heart of the matter, we all want to do what's best for our kids. And I think if you approach I always recommend approaching the coach at the very beginning of the season. So parents, this is when to do it. So the first game, at least in my community in Clintonville,
we could just
Saturday.
Wrap all this up by this Saturday, right?
That's right. Email the coach, say, hey, what do you think about just doing fruit and water this season? Or, hey, what do you think about eliminating the team snack? And I have found in my experience, I've been doing this for a couple of years now and helping people across the country do this on their teams, is when you do it at the beginning of the season and the word comes down from the coach, parents are okay with that. The problem occurs when a parent brings, say, donuts in the first week, and then a parent sends out an email saying, hey, can we do healthy snacks instead? And then people's feelings get
hurt. Judgment comes into play. Yeah.
But especially if it comes from the coach at the beginning of the season, then parents tend to take it really well. And it just becomes another recommendation, like bring your shin guards, you know, bring a healthy snack, or bring your water bottle. We're not going to do Gatorade or whatever mm-hmm. it is. I think that tends to work the best. So the time is now.
So we'd like to hear from folks out there. If you have an idea for a healthy snack for after sports, it's soccer season now, kicking off this weekend. It's going to be cold. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, too. Oh, it's going to be cold. And I remember those days. It is going to be bad. I mean, the most important thing is make sure your kids dress properly at this point.
That's true.
So the Gatorade thing,
It's
not necessary. Is it bad?
Well, I will tell you this. So Gatorade was designed for endurance athletes. It was not designed for 8-year-olds jogging around the soccer field. Mm-hmm. And what it has in it that kids really don't need is that it has sugar in it. A lot of them have artificial colors, artificial flavors. There's a lot of artificial additives in that drink that I think a lot of parents these days are trying to avoid. And it's just unnecessary calories and sugar. Your children can hydrate just as well with water, and then they can replace their electrolytes with food. So sometimes people think electrolytes are these, you know, strange, mysterious
that
things.
That are only found in
Gatorade, but they're actually found in food. So if you go home and have a peanut butter sandwich and a banana, you've replaced your electrolytes as well and done it in a much healthier way and in a much cheaper way. I mean, those packaged drinks and snacks can really add up for families. So why not cut that cost?
I grew up begging mom for snacks and stuff, and she would say, there's apples, there's bread. I mean, she was dead serious. Mm-hmm. The generations, things have really changed in just the last 20 years.
Yeah, and I think there's this whole, I mean, snacking itself is sort of a modern concept, and there's this whole market of snacks for kids, marketed for kids, and they're packaged foods. They've got a lot of added sodium, added sugar, artificial ingredients, and I think the danger is that it's teaching kids that that's what a snack looks like. A snack looks like a bag of cookies in a package. A snack should look like the foods that we serve at mealtime. I mean, like your mom was saying, you know, make a peanut butter sandwich, have some cheese, have an apple. Those are the foods that we should be snacking on. Not to say that those packaged cookies, you know, certainly my kids eat packaged snacks sometimes too. But what I think is that the majority of our snacks should look like meal foods. They should not look like those fun packaged sort of special foods.
Amy in Columbus, you're on the air with Sally Kazemchak, registered dietitian and creator of the blog Real Mom Nutrition. Hi, Amy.
Hi. My kids are a little older than this peewee soccer age now. But years ago when I used to take snacks for them, I would try some, like a bag of cheese squares, some grapes, and some pretzels. And what I found was that people would stand there and kind of look at me and say, well, this ruins my plan for the day because I wanted to grab a bag of chips and get to the car before my kid even opens it because we have other places to go. So for me, the snack time I thought was supposed to be a social time afterwards where kids could set up play dates and do these kinds of things. But really, the snack just seemed like it was, you know, give me the snack, I'm on my way. Mm-hmm. And so I like this idea of maybe we skip it, maybe we do our own thing. Just because I was stuck between wanting to participate, but knowing that what I really wanted to bring and what I had brought in the past, it didn't work for people.
Interesting.
I think that's a good point that parents have very different ideas of what a healthy snack is. So that I mean, that's an excellent point. To her, a healthy snack would be, you know, cheese and sitting around eating that. And some parents just want to grab the chips and go. Mm-hmm. And maybe a healthy snack to them is the chips on the go. And so I think in those cases, eliminating the snack is the way to go if parents can't see eye to eye. And some coaches that I talk to say, I really enjoy that time after the game when the team can sort of sit around, maybe talk about how the game went,
share
the snack.
But if it's 40 degrees and raining outside,
well, right, this weekend,
right?
No one's going to want to hang around. But then if you bring a banana, kids can either grab right. the banana and go mm-hmm. or not. And she's right, too, that a lot of these games happen, at least in my community, in the late morning, right before lunch. So if you give kids a big snack and then you're off to lunch, they're not going to be hungry for right. lunch.
Amy, thanks a lot for that call. Hazel in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Hazel.
Hi. I just had a couple of things. It's interesting that I feel so strong about some of this, but my son's an A majors baseball. And first that we last year had a team that didn't want to do snacks, and a lot of the kids were really disappointed one way or the other. If they won the game, it was kind of a reward. If they lost the game, it was kind of a condolences. So you would hear the, like, oh, no snacks. So I'm not really for that idea. And the other thing, it seems like a losing battle to me. It's kind of like going to McDonald's and ordering a Happy Meal, but switching out the fries for apples. You have a whole concession stand with nothing but, like, Gatorade, Coke, hot dogs, pretzels, you know, everything, nothing healthy there to choose from.
Yeah, sometimes I see apples. I was starting to see apples and oranges, but I know exactly what you're talking about, Hazel. Sally Kazemchak?
Yeah, that brings up a whole other issue, which is a concession stand. So you're not going to see that here in soccer fields, but in a lot of communities with baseball, softball, t-ball, you
football,
will see.
Yeah,
yeah
mm-hmm.
football, you will see concession stands. And there is a movement in many communities to make the foods in those concession stands healthier. The problem is sometimes the profits from those concession stands help fund the team, and the foods that are going to sell are the candy and the sports drinks. So, yeah, that's a whole other ball of wax, and that's definitely a great point and a big concern.
Hazel, thanks a lot. When my kid was in baseball, I was always so relieved when you'd find the stand selling, like, fresh hot pulled chicken and mm-hmm. things like that, at least that mm-hmm. looked like real food.
Right.
You know, and it was a fundraiser, too. You use the term snacktivism that expands beyond sports sidelines and into kids' classrooms and events. What do you mean by snacktivism, first of all?
So a friend of mine coined this term, and I loved it so much that I decided to keep it as my own. And so what it is activism around snacks. And so Any parent of a young child will know that snacks are everywhere these days. A child really cannot participate in an activity without being given a snack. And so what snacktivism is thinking about, A, whether children even need a snack in that moment, and B, whether we can improve the quality of that snack. So research is showing that kids are snacking about 3 times a day or so. And that in and of itself isn't a big deal. It's what they're snacking on. So the research also shows that kids are snacking on salty snacks, candy, and sugar-sweetened beverages. Those are 3 of the top snacks. And kids are getting more than 25% of their calories from snacks every day. And if we're giving them the chips and the candy and the sugar-sweetened drinks, including Gatorade, that's just not doing them any service at all. So what snacktivism is about mobilizing parents to think about all the different places their kids get snacks and rethinking those snacks, you know, suggesting to the coach, you know what, why don't we do away with snacks? Or if a child has a 30-minute Sunday school class, do they really need a snack in that? Could we eliminate that? Or if they do need a snack, could we improve the quality of that snack?
A lot of that's about using food. And I think Hazel got to that a little bit too, as a reward or an enticement.
Yes.
Instead of as a source of nutrition.
Right. And I wrote a whole post on my blog about this. Some parents would say the snack is, especially for the really young players. So, you know, people start their kids in soccer at 4 and 5 years old. And they would tell me, you know, the snack is my child's favorite part of the of the game. And it just occurred to me like, wow, you know, I don't know that we really should be using snacks as an enticement to get them to play sports. It just seems sort of counterintuitive. And so, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with rewarding children for everything they do with a sugary or salty snack. I feel like that sort of sets up a bad pattern, or at least a pattern that is not going to serve them well in life.
Or to make food a reward in any event.
In any case, food really should not be used as a reward. And major health organizations all support that idea. It should not be used as a reward. I can see, you know, I'm totally okay with the end of the season celebration. Bring on the cupcakes, bring on whatever at the end of the season. But I don't think every single game is a reason to be rewarded or have a party.
Have you ever had pushback from parents or teachers when you've tried to introduce the idea, when you tried to be a snacktivist?
On all of my children's sports teams, I've had success. And I have to say, the first time I sent that email to the coach asking that, I just sort of held my breath and wondered what would happen. And the response I got back from that coach was, thank goodness someone said something. I'm so glad you said this. Yes, I have had success. However, I have heard about people in my community and elsewhere definitely getting pushback from both coaches and parents. And what's funny in this experience that I've had is that the pushback comes from the parents. It does not come from the kids. So whenever fruit appears on the sidelines, there's always going to be a couple kids that don't really
right.
want it. And that's okay. But do they have a big fit? Do they scream and cry? Do they even say, where are the chips? Where are the... They actually don't. They're actually fine with it. And so I think parents kind of need to take their cues from their kids. I think sometimes it's the parents' idea of what this is supposed to be, or like you said at the beginning of the show, sort of outdoing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so if our kids are okay with it and it's healthier for them, I think to me it's a no-brainer.
What about eating snacks at home?
Yes.
Where you can control things. If kids are eating healthy meals, can't they get a treat with a snack once in a while if you already know that they're getting all their veggies and their fruits?
Absolutely. And I mean, honestly, like in my home, we have plenty of treats. I love sweets. I love to bake. We definitely do those things as well. But the majority of your snacks, like I said, really should be those meal foods. Absolutely, you can incorporate those fun foods into snacks. And I think that's a nice way to have a balance. But at home, too, people really need to be thinking, is my child grazing all day, or are we having kind of more structured snacks?
Are there too many crumbs on the couch?
Exactly,
yeah.
Which is totally the case at my house sometimes, too. But especially if your kids are getting to dinner and not wanting to eat anything or
yeah.
not, you know, not hungry, it's really frustrating for parents.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what? Think about what they've been eating all day. Did they just have a snack half an hour ago? So you really need to kind of time those snacks well. You don't want a snack too close to dinner. You know, you don't even really want it an hour to 2 hours before, because that is going to wreck their appetite. And, you know, a lot of parents...
And then they're going to want to have another snack later at night because they didn't have enough
snack
at dinner. It's
right.
a vicious cycle.
It is a vicious cycle. And I write a lot about that on my blog, so you can definitely find a lot of resources there.
It's not just kids, though. It's adults, too. Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time, but we've been focusing on kids. But, you know, we're the ones that finish up the bags of chips, usually.
Yeah. According to research, about half of adults eat 2 to 3 snacks a day. And again, I see no problem with snacking as a dietitian. I think it's a great way to get a lot of nutrients, keep your blood sugar stable. But the main reason people report snacking is to satisfy a craving. Huh. So you know what people are snacking on if they're satisfying a craving.
It's never a good sign. Red
broccoli.
Flag.
Yeah.
Red flag. Sally Kazemchak, thanks for joining us. It's always nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Sally Kazemchak is a registered dietitian and creator of the blog Real Mom Nutrition. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening today. That's it for Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.